Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with ultra-distance rider Greg Priddy. How was Tazarov last weekend?
It was the best one I've ever done.
How cool is that?
Yeah. Could have something to do with the fact that
you have a million miles under you.
That definitely helped. Haven't done it in a few years, so it was good to be back. But most importantly, I got to ride with some people that I haven't ridden with in several years, much less seen in several years, actually.
From around here?
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And except for the hill section where we all kind of took our own abilities.
Right.
We were able to ride together and hit the rest stops together and finish together both days.
Nice.
And that's really unusual because usually somebody drops off and Everybody gets split up and they do their own pace. So we were able to stay as a group, and so it made it a lot more fun that way.
And the weather held pretty much?
The weather was very nice, actually. It was The winds were light. We got just sprinkled on a little bit coming into Portsmouth on a Saturday. But aside from that, couldn't ask for more. Lots of riders on the road and lots of old timers.
Well, this was the 50th year.
Yeah. And we saw at the first rest stop on Saturday, we saw, I believe it was Greg Seipel.
Yes.
The son of
the founder of the ride.
So this year they gave everybody their rider number. And then there was a smaller number which had imprinted the year of your first Tazarov.
Wow.
And his rider number matched his first Tazarov. 1962.
Wow.
Yeah, so they gave
that
him a ceremonial number of 1962.
Like, I keep the first number from every ride that I produce.
Yeah,
they hang them on the wall. Really, very cool.
Yeah, so it was a great, well run, as always. Yeah.
So
what else is going on?
Well, it's been quite a week in cycling. Unfortunately, Leopard Trek lost a rider in the Giro.
I heard about that.
Yeah, Walter Whelan died during the third stage of the event. And that's the same stage he won last year.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the day after, which is traditional in many of these European races, nobody raced. They went neutral.
Yeah.
And then the next day, the team pulled from the event. So the Leopard Trek pulled out of.
So what was the cause? Was it?
Evidently, on a downhill, he glanced off of a wall and lost control of the bike and crashed at just some horrific speed.
Mm.
It was just horrific. Mm. And evidently his girlfriend is pregnant.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
So it was not a happy day. And this was the first fatality in over two decades,
mm-hmm.
I think,
mm-hmm.
in the Giro. 25 years, I think they said.
Right.
So that's sad news. And we certainly, feel for Walter Whelan's family and his team.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough on the team. He was a star rider. But Ohio's in the spotlight. Ohio's in the spotlight on two broad scope events this month. May 9th and 10th was the Healthy Communities Active Transportation Conference here. Now, I was invited, and unfortunately, this week just got away from me, and I just never got down there. I was going to go on Monday and just couldn't get there, had a bunch of other stuff going on. The other I am attending. I've already given my RSVP. It's on my calendar. I've cleared my calendar. It's Rails to Trails Conservancy's Advocates Conference to help bring more all-purpose trails to urban low-income communities. And evidently, there's a big push for that. Both at the the federal level and then down to the state level. And it has to do with something local called the Morgana Trail, which is an urban trail up here. But it is a national conference.
Cool.
So that's, Ohio's getting its little self out there. Tonight's show takes us out of the fray, and we're going to go all the way back to the 1800s. In February of 1896, Susan B. Anthony was quoted as saying, "Let me tell you what I think of bicycling." Now, we do know who Susan B. Anthony is, right? Okay.
Yes.
"I think it has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel. I love the phrasing. It's mm-hmm. so cool. So tonight, now, a few weeks ago, the chatter started on the online lists about this new book, Wheels of Change, How Women Rode the Bicycle to Freedom with a Few Flat Tires Along the Way. And the book was written by author Sue Macy. And this book is just stunning. It was published by National Geographic. And for all of you who love the feel and smell and style of a good book, you're going to like this one. It's old-fashioned with a modern twist, and I think you'll enjoy my conversation with Sue. She'll be coming up shortly. And then we're going to zoom forward into this century and maybe beyond into what the future might be like for electric assist bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk to Larry Pizzi, who's the president of Curry Technologies, and their iZip electric assist bicycles. We're at the Urban Press Camp. So we'll be talking to him shortly, and then we'll have our newsies and our notesies and our and a little more chat, maybe.
Okay.
And calendar. Calendar,
right.
Calendar.
Yep.
Okay?
All right. Well, we better welcome Sue here and
yes,
get things
indeed.
Started.
Yes, indeed. Sue Macy, author and obviously athlete. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It's really a privilege to talk to you. A few weeks ago, several of the online bike lists, I monitor the touring list and the tandem list, started buzzing about a book.
That's called, good to hear.
Yeah, Wheels of Change, How Women Rode the Bicycle to Freedom with a Few Flat Tires Along the Way. And it's a very great title, but more than that, it's just a beautiful, beautiful book. I contacted your publisher. She graciously sent me a copy. And so I just had to talk to you.
I'm really glad to hear that because I'm excited about the book, too.
Well, and I did a little bit of research about you, and you seem to write a lot about women and women in sports. And I don't think there are a lot of us out there, the women in sports thing, mm-hmm. at the level that you are, and in my business, sort of at the level that I am, which is a radio person.
Right.
So women in the bicycle business have been few and far between. How did you come to write about women and the bicycle? I know you've done other sports, but how did you get interested in the bicycle?
Well, way back in the mid-90s, I did a book called Winning Ways, which was a social history of American women in sports for young adults. And when I was doing the research, it covers about 150 years of women in sports in the United States. I came across these interesting bicycle facts. I came across Frances Willard, who was the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, who taught herself with the help of others too, learned how to ride a bicycle at age 53 and wrote a best-selling book about it in 1895. So the fact that she wrote about this and how it was a revelation to her and the spiritual journey that she went on riding a bicycle was something that I just kept in the back of my mind. I also found that Susan B. Anthony in 1896 said that bicycling has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. Things kept stewing, I guess, and I was looking for a new book idea a couple of years ago, and I convinced my editors at National Geographic that this was a great book. So that was the way it started.
Well, it is a great book, and it's so chock full of stuff. You know, it's got. It,
well, great I wanted to do a kind of a scrapbook as well as a narrative book, and I think we succeeded.
I think you did. I didn't really realize that's what your goal was, but you did, and all the little call outs and the beautiful illustrations. It's really, really nice. It also has a foreword by Leah Misbach Day. And people who have listened to the show will know that FK Day, her husband, and she are the World Bicycle Relief people. How did you get kind of hooked up with her?
Well, that came through my editor, Jennifer Emmett, at National Geographic. Her husband works with nonprofits, so he, I think, had worked with World Bicycle Relief, and they suggested that Leah write the foreword, and it was perfect because this story, although the book focuses on the 1880s and 90s, it really does come forward to the modern day because the bicycle is once again relevant and important, and it holds a lot of answers to what's going on in the country with energy and the economy. So it was great to be able to have Leah bring the story to the modern day.
Well, and Leah's organization works with women who are looking to be emancipated, you know,
right,
women
exactly.
in Africa. It, yes, exactly.
It was a perfect compliment.
Yeah, it is. It's a great fit. I was really glad to see World Bicycle Relief as part of it. So, how did you didn't do these illustrations. You had a lot of help with the book.
Well, they're all contemporary from the 1880s and 90s. So I did the photo research.
Okay, you did.
And what happened was because there's such a wonderful bicycle community in the country and in the world, I found a website called Tubulosity, which is out of Seattle. And Eric Shallett runs it. It's a great website, tubulosity.com, and he had a lot of ephemera from the 1890s on his site. And I wrote to him and said, you know, he had a lot of pictures of sheet music covers from the 1890s, songs about the bicycle and other things. And he told me that most of them came from a collector who happens to live an hour away from me in New Jersey.
See what I mean by small world?
Right. Actually, yeah. the collector, Norman Basso, had passed away, but his wife, Dottie, still had the collection, and she invited me down to her apartment. And I brought my scanner, and she had a scanner, and we actually scanned images for 5 hours.
Wow.
So a lot of these images are from their collection and haven't been published in any book. So it was a wonderful find, and it helped inform what I wrote because I decided to do a little feature about bicycle music. And, you know, even though this book focuses on women, there was so much bicycle culture, and by seeing all these different examples of ephemera, I decided to round out the book with the larger story of the bicycle culture at the time.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you go through, toward the end of the book, you start at 1770, and you come forward into about 1920s.
Right, the timeline.
Yeah, the timeline, the highlights in cycling and women's history. And it would be interesting to go forward even further, but it looks like we're starting over in a way with a whole new bicycle culture. It seems that bicycling is everywhere. We do this show every week, and we have so much material to talk about. I want to talk more, though, about your writing this book about women in particular, because women in our industry are not necessarily prevalent. It's a boy's world, a man's world. Mm-hmm. So, and I know you write a lot about women.
Yes.
Do you think that women can affect change big enough to bring bicycling back into the mainstream? That's really what I'm looking for.
Well, it's interesting that you say that it's a male's world, because I've been hearing it from a lot of women out there who are reacting to the book and connecting with the story. And actually, my first review was on a website called Cycle and Style, which is about women in bicycling. And it seems that there are a lot of writers out there, especially on the web and sites, that are really either they're about women in cycling or they're open. Yeah, I've found that even the men who are cyclists are kind of accepting this book with open arms.
Oh, I don't doubt that, because it was men who brought it up, by the way.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, the way I found it out.
I don't know. It seems like it's really a community issue now, cycling. I mean, if you want to promote safety and good health and you know, economic stability, it helps to have cycling as part of your community, because you can commute to work for nothing. You can it's just really important. And since it's almost a family issue in a way, so
yes,
I would think that it's, you know, men and women working together to get this going. You know, maybe racing is often a male sport, although there are plenty of female racers. But I don't know. I think on the grassroots level, women should have a stake. And I don't know how it it comes about.
Well, it's starting to happen on the advocacy level. It does seem that there are a lot of women in advocacy, and there are women on the boards of places like the League of American Bicyclists. And it is getting better, I think, for the next generation coming up.
Interesting. Well, you know, I'm not a great cyclist. I'm in my 50s. I used to cycle a lot when I was in college, but I started riding again about 6 years ago when I decided to do one of the Danskin triathlons.
Brave.
And I started riding regularly because I wanted to train. And a couple of years ago, I did one of the Trek triathlons. And, you know, Trek and Danskin are both very strong supporters of women in sports, especially biking, swimming, and running. So I would think that, if more companies got behind women's efforts, it would be really helpful.
I want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Sue Macy. She's the author of Wheels of Change, How Women Rode the Bicycle to Freedom with a Few Flat Tires Along the Way. And that's so true. Do you change your own flat tires, Sue?
You know, I cross my fingers. I have never had one, but I do have
a tube. The kiss of death right there.
Yeah. Well, I have a tube. I have the little lever. I watched the video on how to do it.
Oh, good girl. Good girl. That is one thing I can do is change a flat tire.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna go back to the book here. You talk about a Charlotte Smith.
Yes.
And how she was one of these women who just thought women should stay at home and have babies, evidently.
No, it's the interesting thing about Charlotte Smith is she was a proponent of women in the workplace. She was a real feminist, but she really felt that cycling was an affront to women's security. She felt that women would be out on the road and would be prey to either physical attacks or attacks on their virtue in other ways.
Huh.
And so she was this strange amalgam of a feminist who was anti-bicycling. And she mounted a campaign which it fell pretty flat, but she was very vocal about the fact that she said many a girl has come to her ruin through a spin on a country road.
Yeah, some of the language is interesting, you know, ride the wheel, you know, not the bicycle, but it's, get the wheel. I think it's really interesting that
they were trying to figure out, you know, the vocabulary as they went.
Sure. And so there was even at some point, doctors were doing studies and saying that, well, if you ride too much, you know, then you're going to have problems. I think they were even talking about getting pregnant and, you know, don't
right.
ride. Yes.
You should not. There was once in England, there was a British medical journal that had a 10-part series on cycling and health in the 1890s. And one of the things, they said that women should ride except when, if they were pregnant, they absolutely should not, and then they should refrain for a couple of months after they had their baby, and they should never race, but they should ride, because they did see the importance of exercise, which was a major breakthrough, because for much of the 19th century, it was felt that women shouldn't exercise because they were too delicate. One of the reasons they were delicate is they were wearing corsets, which constricted their organs so they couldn't breathe. and actually the bicycle helped do away with the corset on a day-to-day basis, because it became clear as more and more women were riding that the clothing they wore had to be more conducive to exercise. So the corset was tossed aside. You know, it's all related, the bicycle and the health. And there was also a concern that women would be sexually stimulated on their bicycles.
Really?
Yes. And it was, and I didn't write too much about it in the
book.
No,
you didn't.
But
you mentioned it a little bit.
Yeah, I did. And there was actually a women's saddle, which was designed that would tilt backwards instead of forwards, so the women wouldn't rest their sensitive areas on the peak of the saddle.
Right. I did read that.
Yeah.
I do fittings all the time. People still complain about that. So.
Now it's actually men who are having more issues. I mean, not with that, but with...
Right.
With,
dysfunction, we call it.
Yes. So there were discussions. I mean, medical professionals, by and large, saw the pros of bicycle, which was, you know, the exercise, and it would help women become sturdier and better mothers because they could have better children. but there was an issue of how intense women should give themselves over to riding, how strongly they or should they temper it and still maintain some kind of a balance.
There are so many wonderful little pieces, parts in this book. One that I particularly liked was Brooklyn Eagle, Brooklyn, New York, March 25th, 1895, drew the line at bloomers that the British Columbia police object to a woman's bicycle costume.
Right.
Yeah.
There was a lot of debate about what women should wear. And bloomers had been popular in the 1850s among feminists. And Amelia Bloomer was an editor who first wrote about them in a feminist newspaper. But even she stopped wearing them because there was such a backlash, because it wasn't felt that women should wear bifurcated garments, which are anything that looked like pants.
Right.
That was a no-no. So they sort of were tossed aside. And then in the 1890s, when women started riding the safety, they actually had a skirt guard, which was kind of a mesh that was put over the tires so the skirt wouldn't be sucked up into the tire.
Right.
But women did start wearing shorter skirts and even divided skirts, and sometimes bloomers, because it was much more comfortable and easier, and you were less likely to get your fabric caught up in the tires and fall on your behind.
Right. That was putting it nicely.
Yes.
So if we move forward in time a little bit, this book sort of ends with the change of the century.
Yeah.
When you decided to do this particular research, why did you stop there?
Because the automobile really ended the bicycle craze. The bicycle continued to be used, but soon after the turn of the century, it started to be consigned to children. Certainly by the time I was growing up in the 60s, kids rode bicycles, not many parents. Maybe your odd physician was still into health. But what happened was, when the automobile came about, a lot of the bicycle repair shops became gas stations. A lot of the bicycle inventors and bicycle sellers, like the Wright brothers, Duryea, they either turned to airplanes or cars. So it suddenly became yesterday's news, in a way. And women, their new challenge was, should they drive or not, a car. So the bicycle, it had this great heyday. I know it's coming, it's been coming back, but there really was a kind of a clear-cut end to the excitement that was just crazy. They were selling a million bicycles a year in the mid-1890s.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, and what happened was the market was so flooded that bicycle manufacturers started shipping them overseas, or they stopped, they went out of business altogether, or they switched to, electric bicycles or motorcycles. And so there was, economically and socially, everything turned to the next great invention.
Yeah. Unfortunately,
yeah.
We're still fighting that today,
yes.
At least from this little corner of the world. Well, so Sue, what's on your agenda now? What are you working on?
Well, I've got a few more sports ideas.
Good.
I actually have I wrote my first picture book, which is for young audiences, about the first women's college basketball game ever, the first intercollegiate game, which was also in the 1890s, 1896, between Stanford and UC Berkeley.
Wow.
Yeah, in April 1896, Stanford won 2-1.
I was just going to ask what the score was.
Men were not allowed to watch the game because the Berkeley women didn't want to perspire in front of them.
Oh, that's hilarious.
The Stanford women did not care. I've written mostly for, Wheels of Change, fortunately, is appealing to adults as well as teenagers. I've often written for grades 5 through high school, I guess. And so it was kind of a new thing to try and go younger. And I'm also trying to lock down my next great topic. I'm thinking about television in some way.
Really?
With women. I mean, I mostly write women's history.
Yeah, you do. And you have a wonderful website. If the listeners are interested, it's SueMacy.com.
Right, SueMacy.
Right, and so I assume Wheels of Change is available pretty much everywhere right now?
Yes, I'm happy to say. Happy to say it is.
Yes.
And actually, my website was designed by the same woman who designed Wheels of Change.
And it really, it's a lovely book, and it's a hardbound book. It's not a soft cover book, and I really like that. I like hardbound. I like books.
Yes. Well, I'm glad. It's, you know, we had the option or the opportunity to try and have a Kindle edition, but without the images, it really wouldn't be the same.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I would agree with you. And the only thing, I actually was given a Kindle this past week, and the only thing I don't really like about it is there's no page numbers.
Oh.
I like page numbers. I like to know where I am.
Well, it repaginates depending on how large the type is.
I know, too. But that just doesn't work for me all the time.
You know? Well, maybe one day there'll be an iPad edition, because then you could continue with the art, because the art is really, I think I have 84 original images in this book.
The art is beautiful. Right down to your typeface. I love the font that you used for your regular copy. It's really, really nice.
That's great to hear. The typeface actually changed a day before the book went to the printer.
No, really?
Everything was in place, and the art director said, didn't we talk about changing the font? So
it doesn't say what the font is. Oh, I love it. I think I did tell you at one point that my background is art and history.
Yeah.
But I'm not seeing what the typeface is, but I really love it. And I just love the whole book. I think it's fun. You can just pick it up anywhere and just grab a page and get some really cool looking stuff and some interesting facts. I really wish you a lot of luck with the continued selling to all ages, because
thank you,
I think it appeals to anybody who's interested in women's studies, in bicycling, in history, in the United States, in transportation. It's got everything.
Well, it's nice. It seems to be a story that hasn't been told in this depth. It's been told, Herlihy's book on the bicycle has some information about women. And I've seen various chapters, but nothing. Nobody's ever written about the racing women that I found. And I was really excited to find their stories, too.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show this evening. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And lots of luck. I'm going to keep watching to see what your next project is.
Okay. Well,
all right.
Thank
Have
you.
A great night. Hey, ride your bike.
I will.
All right.
I will.
Bye-bye, Sue.
Bye-bye.
Sue Macy is the author of the new book, Wheels of Change, How Women Rode the Bicycle to Freedom with a Few Flat Tires Along the Way. And she spoke to us from her home in New Jersey. The book is available through National Geographic Press.
It's lovely. I love this book.
You're going to loan this to me when you're done?
Yes, I will.
I would love to read that.
And you know what? It's got, let me tell you, make some time, because it's got lots of, it's chock full of stuff, as
it's
they
deceptive, because it's not a real thick book.
No, but it's a slim volume, I think is what we call that. But it does have lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff. And
very cool.
Obviously, a ton of work went into the research.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And then we'll come back and get to our news and calendar. So please stay tuned on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Wednesday, May 25th and Thursday, May 26th, the Cleveland Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers and CWRU present Energy Tech 2011, a two-day conference featuring leading-edge technology papers and corporate presentations covering sustainable energy and distribution. An evening reception and keynote address will open the conference on Tuesday, May 24th. It all takes place on the CWRU campus in University Circle. More details and registration information at energytech2011.org.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and about this time every week, we try to bring you up to date on what's happening in the cycling news, and that is Diane's job, so take it away.
So May 6th, out of Washington, D.C., Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, affectionately called BRAIN, posted that Representatives Doris Matsui and Stephen LaTourette, our own Ohio representative, introduced the Safe and Complete Streets Act of 2011, H.R. 1780, into the U.S. House of Representatives. The federal measure would direct states and regions to adopt policies to provide for the needs of all users of the transportation system, including people of all ages and abilities who are walking, bicycling, and taking the bus.
Nice.
I knew that Representative Matsui was going to be introducing this. I did not know that Representative LaTourette would be. So I have contacted Congressman LaTourette's office, and we are trying to make arrangements, have him come on and talk about his involvement in Complete Streets and just, you know, cycling in general.
Cool.
Yeah. How old do you want to be when you stop riding a bicycle?
How long am I going to live?
Well, evidently, the 94-year-old lifelong cyclist finds her wheels with her daughter's help. This is from the St. Petersburg Times on TampaBay.com. And Phyllis Harmon wasn't sure why the young man was handing her a helmet. The 94-year-old hadn't been on a bike in years. But on Saturday, the lifelong cyclist and oldest living member of the U.S. Bicycling Hall of Fame found herself at Bicycle Outfitters. Earlier that morning, Harmon's daughter, Carol Terrazas, 61, had driven her to the shop. There, owner Adam Bayland approached the two with matching silver helmets. And Terrazas revealed her Mother's Day surprise, a tandem bike ride.
Oh, nice.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. Oh, my, Harmon murmured as Bayland fastened the teal chin strap for her. They didn't have these when I started riding.
Oh, they didn't.
That is so cool. She said she got her first one bike at 12 using $28 she'd saved from babysitting. So I just thought that that was one of the cutest stories of the week. I think it's so cool. She does complain that she can't be the one in control. Really?
Yeah.
Another cool thing, and I don't know if anybody has, we've talked about this before. This is the Safe Routes to School stuff. So if you have a child and you want your child to start riding to school, you can actually go to a sort of the Safe Routes to School website and learn about how to get your school involved. Well, right here in Northeast Ohio, 1,001 Northeast Ohio students biked to school on the challenge's first day. There was a bike to school challenge May 10th.
Oh, this week.
This week.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Century Cycles. So we'll give them a little shout out. And it was Rocky River and Bay Village. And they ended up with 1,001 kids riding to school that day. Some of it has to do with bike month, being bike month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so here's how it broke down. Bay Middle School counted 527 bikes, which is almost 60% of the school.
Wow.
Rocky River Middle School counted 276 bikes, which is almost 50% of the school. And Bay High School counted 198 bikes, which is 25% of the school. Grand total of 1,001 bikes on Monday, May 9th, and a terrific start for the three-week program. So congratulations to Century Cycles, Raleigh Bicycles, Chipotle, and I just think it's awesome. And yeah, the Rocky River and Bay School Districts. Yeah, they got behind that.
Nice.
So I think everybody can get behind that. So that's the end of my stories for the day. You got some calendars?
You skipped over the one that I was hoping you were going to...
Which one?
This one here.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Last story of the evening, Washington. U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, our buddy.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Yes, he has. He signaled on Tuesday that his department would be looking into measures to encourage automobile drivers to observe better safety standards when it came to bicyclists cohabitating. Ooh, on roadways.
Sounds dirty.
Yes, it does. In an interview with the Huffington Post, the Illinois Republican praised various cities for restructuring transportation policy around cleaner forms of transit, singling out the construction of bike lanes to encourage biking as particularly effective. But with additional bikers on the road come additional risks. And as head of the Department of Transportation, LaHood noted his quote-unquote concern over the way that bikers are treated when they are on streets.
Sometimes.
I'm concerned that people who are driving cars have a level of respect for bikers, and that's the reason that we have these bike lanes. Bikers have as much right to the streets as anybody driving a car, and I am concerned about their safety. Told that his heartfelt defense of bikers came off like the musings of a run-in-the-mill hipster, LaHood professed genuine confusion. I don't even know what that term means, he says. So, rah-rah us.
I just thought that was great that they accused him of being a hipster, and he had no idea what they were even calling him.
Well, at any rate, that's the end of my rant for the night.
All right, time for a little calendar here. We'll go through this rather quickly. Next Sunday, May 22nd, is the Canalway Bicycle Poker Run. That's in Massillon, Ohio. It's a 15 or 22-mile tour on the Towpath Trail, and you get to stop and draw cards at checkpoints for the best poker hand. Top 10 hands win prizes, and so do jokers. It's all-ages ride, and proceeds benefit the Massillon Area Greenways Incorporated and the Stark County Bicycle Club. Ernie'sBikeShop.com is the website for more details on that. Saturday, May 28th is the 11th Jerry's Jeromesville Journey. That starts and ends in Oberlin, Ohio. It's a free century tour with a 50-mile cutoff that visits the rolling and hilly portions of southern Lorain and northern Ashland counties, and it's sponsored by the Lorain Wheelman. LorainWheelman.org is the site for information on that. Looking out into June, don't forget that Cleveland Touring Club's Sunday in June rolls out from Century Village in Burton, Ohio on Sunday, June 12th. There are 25, 50, 63, and 100-mile routes available. It's a full-service tour, and you can get more information at clevelandtouringclub.org. And that brings us to the end of calendar and news, and time to welcome our next guest.
Yes, indeed. We are bringing on Larry Peasy, president of Curry Technologies. We're going to learn all about electric bikes. Larry, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me this evening.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Diane.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So we've kind of known each other for a few years. You have a long history in the bicycle business. I remember when you were really a bike dealer in Philadelphia.
Yeah. I had bike tech stores, three stores in Philadelphia from 1979 through 1990. Those were sort of my roots. I grew up in Philadelphia riding and racing bicycles, using a bike as my primary form of transportation, and started working in the bike shop in the early 70s.
Where did you go from there?
Well, from there, my wife and I moved to northern Maryland, and I went on the road repping for a couple of different bicycle companies, starting with Raleigh, USA, until about 1994. And then I went to work for Bell Sports, a helmet company that also owned a bicycle division.
Which division did Bell own?
Bell owned Mongoose Bicycles for a period of time.
Oh, you know what? I did not know that. Duh.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And then they sold Mongoose to the Brunswick Corporation.
Right, right.
And I went along with that transaction until about 1999, and then went to work for Schwinn GT. And Schwinn, when they owned both brands, went through a bankruptcy in 2002.
Right.
And my wife had gotten tired of moving four times in 10 years, and I went to work for Curry Technologies in just about 9 years ago. In May of 2002.
So Curry has been around how long?
Wow, Curry has been around for a long time, since about 1995 in one form or another. And a very interesting company founded by a guy by the name of Dr. Malcolm Curry, who was chairman at Hughes. And
the aircraft company?
Excuse me?
Hughes Aircraft?
Yeah, Hughes Aircraft.
I see.
General Motors bought Hughes at some point in time, and when they bought Hughes, Dr. Curry was nearing retirement, and they put him over an electric vehicle project that actually became really famous. It became the EV1 project, which was one of the first electric car projects in the country to be really well funded. And post-retirement, he, you know, had developed a passion for electric vehicles, and he decided that he would form Curry Technologies as a development company. I met him while I was at Brunswick Corporation as vice president of marketing, and they had developed this little propulsion system, little drive system that could be attached to pretty much, you know, any full-size adult bicycle to electrify it.
So that was really early on.
That was really early on. The company was formed in 95. This was about 1998.
Okay.
And a number of years ago, and quite frankly, at that point in time, it just didn't it didn't really make much sense to me. I you know, I was a few years younger then.
And, really?
the thought of putting you know, a motor and batteries on a bike, just, you know, I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to do that.
And I think that's finally changing a little, and that's why we're talking to you.
Exactly.
Okay. Because it is changing, and today's market is looking way different than it did then.
You know, the mobility paradigm sort of around the world is really changing. Going back to 2008, it became really apparent to a lot of people with escalating gas prices in the United States that, you know, people needed an alternative to taking short trips in their car. And this was a, you know, a real bone for bicycles in general, but, you know, let's be realistic about things. A lot of people don't ride bicycles because, you know, either believe they're not fit enough, or they believe that, you know, they've got terrain, or they've got something working against them, some sort of inner human resistance, you know, heavy winds, big hills, whatever it might be. Electric bicycles help to overcome some of those objections. And business really started to scale pretty rapidly in 2008, driven by, you know, the financial motivations of high gas prices.
So the bicycles that I saw at Urban Press Camp, the iZip, Curry Technologies actually has a scooter division and a bicycle division.
Well, we actually have...
Oh, you have more than that.
We have two ranges of product that are closely associated. One brand is called iZip, and there are premium electric bicycles that we sell primarily in the specialty channel, bike shops and electric bike specialty stores, full-service retail environments. And then we make a range of products under the iZip brand, which are sold in the mass market. And they include not only a couple of models of lower-end electric bicycles, but they also include a range of light electric scooters that people use for neighborhood transportation.
So how many bicycle dealers are getting into the electric bicycle business? So if we say there are 4,500 dealers around the country, what percentage of them are actually looking at the electric bicycle as a possible another line of SKUs?
Well, that's a great question, because it's changing before our eyes. I mean, this year again, we've got you know, gas prices even topping where they were in 2008, and or at least on pace to exceed where they were in 2008. And we've been opening up a lot of new dealers since the beginning of this year. Currently, Curry Technologies has about 450 specialty dealers around the country. So about 10% of the IBDs are selling our product. There are a number of other brands of electric bicycles in the market today, and we're not selling to everyone that sells electric bikes, but I would say that somewhere around 15% of the independent bicycle dealers around the country are testing the category. And the reason I state it that way is that a number of them are trying it but are skeptical about it.
Well, that's not going to help.
No.
I think they need to get behind it.
Very challenging. But,
sure.
You know, that's the reality of the situation. You know, most bicycle shops are, you know, as you very well know, are staffed by cycling enthusiasts, which is, you know, a great thing if what you're selling is enthusiast product. Where we're finding that our product does the best is in an environment where people are selling bikes that are focused on transportation. And when the mindset of the selling staff is one of selling transportation, an electric bike makes more sense to them. It's not counterintuitive. You know, and as I said earlier, I came up from, you know, the sport side of the industry. That was my passion when I was, you know, in my teens and 20s. And that's why it didn't make a tremendous amount of sense when Dr. Curry introduced it to me in 1998. But what's happening around the world is that in countries where people think about bicycles for transportation first, like Western Europe and many places in Asia, the category is seeing explosive growth. In Holland, which is probably a model city for transportation cycling, electric bicycles account for about one-third of all bicycles sold in 2010.
Wow.
And also about 50% of the revenue. So it's becoming a really serious business in certain places in the world. While it hasn't reached that proportion in the United States, it feels like we're somewhere about 5 or 7 years behind some of the countries in Western Europe where the category has really scaled.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Larry Pizzi, who's the president of Curry Technologies, and we're talking about electric bicycles. Let me ask you a question about the United States. I understand how Europe and Asia might be, but who is your target customer?
Dan, that's a really great question. Transportation cycling is not a huge market today in the United States. What we find, our primary customer are folks my age and a bit older.
Yes, aging, but you're only 25.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
No, in reality, aging baby boomers are our biggest sector. I mean, you know, many of us found our freedom on a bicycle, and you know, we've been a generation that's really outdoors and active, and just because we're getting a little bit older doesn't mean we want to, you know, park ourselves on the couch. But in reality, we might be intimidated to, you know, go out on a long ride, or we might, you know, be developing some issues like, you know, problems with our knees or a little bit of arthritis or something like that. And you know, the concept of riding a bike a significant distance, becomes difficult. Electric bikes help overcome a lot of those things, and there's not a week that goes by that I don't get a letter from someone that's gotten on one of our product and it's become sort of a life-changing thing for them.
So it was life-changing for you as a youngster. It becomes life-changing for somebody as they enter their senior years. That's kind of a cool thing, I think. So explain how the electric bike actually works.
Well, Curry Technologies offers a number of different types of drive systems that we market as Curry Electro Drive. What I have learned in the 9 years that I've been involved in the category is that a number of consumers that are interested in electric bicycle generally aren't coming from a cyclist perspective. So the concept of a pedal assist bike where you have to be pushing on the pedals to get some element of assist is not necessarily what they think they want when they're in the market for a bike. They want something that provides twist and go, throttle actuated power on demand. But what they find after they ride for some period of time is that when you're in the saddle for 45 minutes or an hour or longer, that your wrist sort of gets fatigued holding the throttle open. And having an electric bike that is able to offer pedal assist as opposed to power on demand is something that makes a lot more sense.
So how does pedal assist work?
Well, it works a couple different ways. We have some systems that are torque actuated so that the harder you're pushing on the pedals, the more the motor provides assistance. So it sort of gives you a proportionate level of assist. And then we have other systems that are cadence actuated. So the faster you're spinning the pedals, the more the motor is offering an assist function.
Are there actual gear changing mechanisms on these bikes?
Sure. Most of all of our bikes have at least a rear derailleur.
Okay.
So,
External rear derailleur?
External rear derailleur. So you're utilizing the bike just like you would a normal, like a manual bicycle.
Okay.
And you ride just like you would a normal bicycle. And in pedal assist mode, the motor just provides a proportionate boost. Being a cyclist, that certainly seems, most intuitive to me, and that's what I prefer. But as I said, folks that aren't cyclists think that they want a throttle, and so we give them the option. Most of our bikes have a pedal assist or power on demand option that they can, the user can select the mode. So that if they think they want a throttle, we give them a throttle.
On the same bike.
And then when they decide their wrist gets tired, they can put it in pedal assist mode.
Oh, so the same bike has throttle and pedal assist. That's interesting.
Exactly.
So it's not like you have to choose one or the other and pick a model.
That's precisely
interesting.
Right.
Interesting. So the bike that I saw at our Urban Press Camp was very pretty. It was white. I remember that. It was beautiful. It had this kind of large down tube. That was where the mechanism is to give you the assist?
That's where the battery is stored in that particular bike.
Okay.
We make about 15 different models in our range. And as most cyclists know, bikes are really function specific in that, there are different kinds of bikes for different kinds of riding. And the same is true for an electric bike. So if you want a real upright, comfortable kind of a position for city riding, that sort of puts you in one model. If you want something that's a little more sport-oriented, a little more nimble handling, that puts you in another. The bike that you're talking about is called the Ultra, and that's a sport-oriented bike. That seems like the right bike that you would choose, Diane.
It's a cool-looking bike.
It's a very cool-looking bike. And having the battery in the down tube really enables us to keep the center of gravity as low as possible.
That makes sense.
And also balance the weight between the two wheels,
right,
which is really, pretty important, especially when you're talking about a performance product.
So can you put a trailer on one of these bikes?
Absolutely.
Okay,
and
so you could haul your kids around
do,
if you want.
Not only for carrying, groceries and loads, but also for carrying their children around.
Right. Very cool. So what do you think, looking into your crystal ball, will be the growth pattern of these electric bikes? Do you think that more and more people will be looking at them seriously? Obviously, you're selling bikes. It's not an issue.
Well, yeah. It's really difficult to say. Obviously, looking into the future is always something that's difficult to project. But, what my gut tells me is that, the mobility paradigm is changing in this world. And, fossil fuels that we use to, fuel our automobiles today and cars that get, 15 or 18 miles to a gallon, before you know it, it's going to be a thing of the past.
I hope you're right.
And I don't really think that clean cars are necessarily the answer. We have, especially out here in L.A. where I live, we've got incredibly congested cities and we've got pollution and, you know, all kinds of reasons for people to get out of their cars and onto a more practical vehicle. You know, the statistics are such that so many trips by car are relatively short distance that,
right.
you know, people can very easily use a bike. And the reality is only a small fraction of Americans ride bikes, something less than 20% at all, even for recreation. And the mode share, on average, in American cities is about 1% trips by bike. If we can move that number up to somewhere around 5%, where we've been able to in certain cities like Portland, Oregon, and New York City is fast on its way of getting that kind of mode share by building good infrastructure for cycling, I think we're going to be able to make some significant changes that are really going to impact the way our cities operate. And like I said, mobility is changing, and I think two-wheel vehicles are going to be a major part of that, and a subset of that is going to be light electric vehicles like electric bicycles and electric scooters.
Well, I think it's a fascinating topic, and I think that we should tell people how they can look at the Curry bikes at their different options. You have a website.
Sure. Our URL is currytech.com, CURRIETECH.com. And there you've got a dealer locator and all kinds of great information on the product.
Well, I look forward to seeing you at Interbike.
Great. I look forward to seeing you as well, Diane.
And I really appreciate you spending time with me this evening telling me about the electric bike business. You've actually piqued my interest more than you might think.
Great. I appreciate it, Diane. Thank you.
All right. Have a great evening, Larry.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Larry Peasy is the president of Curry Technologies, a maker of electric assist bicycles, and he joined us from the headquarters there in Southern California.
Well, you know, I can't disagree with his thinking. I think that there is a portion of the market that will perhaps get on this bike where they wouldn't get on another.
Some people have commutes that are just about that much too long to really reasonably ride without an assist, and I think this could possibly bridge that gap.
It could push them over the edge there.
Yeah, yeah, and you might arrive a little less sweaty, a little less fatigued.
You also have people living in retirement communities that might be using golf carts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'd be much better off, you know, at least getting some exercise.
Sure.
Because you do still pedal the bike,
mm-hmm.
which is what I didn't quite get at first.
Right.
But this one he showed, this Ultra, was really a cool-looking bike. Yeah.
And it can help with if your commute is hilly.
Yes.
You know, that one hill might be standing in your way.
That's right.
And even if you can climb the hill, do you want to do it before you go to work every morning and kind of...
Right.
We will see what happens.
Yes, we will. Well, have we, chewed up another hour?
We certainly have.
And it was a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of interesting stuff, as always.
So.
And so we appreciate you listening or downloading, as the case may be. And we hope you will come back and join us next Saturday for another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.